Hello, this is Hannah Solomon. I'm a student interviewer with the Dartmouth Vietnam Project in Rauner Library at Dartmouth College. Today is March 11th, 2016, and I'm speaking with Sue Tabla, who is calling in from... Where are you calling in from?
Silver Spring, Maryland, near Washington, D.C.
Near Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for speaking with me today. Did you want to say a little bit about why you chose to do this interview?
I'm doing this because my husband, John, was a Vietnam veteran, and it had a big impact on him and our lives. And he's hospitalized now and can't do it himself. So, and I had just said he wanted to revise the novel he wrote when he came back from Vietnam, but can't do that either. So this is just my chance to get more information about him out and about how it affects us. Because when you're young, you think you study history, and it's just something that you... Oh, I'm done. This was a phone call. I'd re-record it. But what happens is history, you get caught up in it. You don't control it. It happens. I feel like we were very much people of our time. You know, we campaigned for Lyndon Johnson in 64, and then in 64... signed the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. You know, and I remember when John was at graduate school and we saw Lyndon Johnson come there, and we were both very, you know, oh, that's the president. and then later we were so disgusted with him because of what happened in that war.
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, you do what seems right at the time, and then later on you look back and it's just really strange and interesting.
Well, thank you so much for doing this interview. I'd like to start back way at the beginning. Tell me a little bit about your family, about your childhood. When were you born?
My childhood or John's?
Your childhood. What'll start with you?
I moved all over the country. I was born in Utah. I moved 12 times before I graduated from high school. John and I were high school sweethearts. He was my memory, which is kind of ironic because now he's in a memory institution. And I don't know, he was... He was the most... I'll choke up.
Take your time.
Moving around is very hard. And after a while, you get to feel like it doesn't matter what you do or what you say because you'll just leave it behind. And John was this change in my life. And then there, you know, if I get talking about myself, that could take forever. I'm a garrulous old woman of 74 now, so
I would love to hear your story, though. I'd like to build up some background, if you would like to talk about it.
Oh, my parents, I have one sister who's 4 years older. When I was 2 years old, I guess, she got polio and had to have, there was no real treatment, but there was the Sister Kenny treatment. My father thought that was, you know, useless and didn't want my mother to do it, but his mother would thought it would might help, and she came from Pennsylvania, and my mother and his mother wrapped my sister in boiling hot old blankets, and that did keep her, she did get paralysis on her right side left her, and it turns out later, you know, the high temperatures will pull the virus sometime anyway. But in the meantime, they left me with this other woman, who a friend of my mother. My mother always had really good friends, and they were. She was a pretty good judge of character, and so she left me with this woman, I think, Dinah Bischoff, in Utah, and in Ogden. And then when my mother came to get me, much later, I said I didn't want to go with that mean lady. And it was a mean lady, and she was sort of at her best when she was swearing, because then she wasn't uptight. She wanted to belong. Well, strange. Oh, and I learned something interesting from her. I'm part Indian. I never knew that until she was senile and told me, but her father's mother was half Indian, and they lived in, my mother grew up in Indiana, and her father and mother were in the Ku Klux Klan because that was the social thing to do there.
Wow.
So, yeah, but my mother is the least racist woman of her generation that I've ever known. You know, I mean, she was totally unprejudiced herself, but I think that was because she knew that he was part Indian, and because one time, and this came out when I was talking about having my hair done and how I couldn't have French braids anymore. She said, "Well, you have that greasy Indian hair like I do." And so that's how she thought of it, you know?
Wow.
From her parents. And so, she loved her father more than her mother, I know, because her mother was mean to her. Although she was, my grandmother was a really funny lady. And then move all over the place, and that's kind of how I was.
Where else did you live?
Where else did I live?
Yes.
Oh, let's see. After, lived a couple places in Utah, lived in Indiana, near Terre Haute, lived in Oak Park, Illinois, lived in West Chicago, lived in Garden Home, Wisconsin, which was kind of, that was, West Chicago wasn't the west side of Chicago, it was this little hick town, and then we moved into Milwaukee, and because they didn't want to have another mortgage, we bought this house that was in a terrible neighborhood, and there was all kinds of tough kids, and my parents, oh, my mother made me register myself in third grade, and that was scary enough, and they never believed us that the schools there were just terrible. And the kids brought zip guns to school and things like that. And anyway, then the journal published an article where the kids had broken into the school and busted it up in the summertime. And then they finally believed us, and then we moved out into the country, the other three. And then we ended up in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin, which is like a upper-class suburb, which was at one time the second richest suburb in the country, I think.
Oh, wow. So quite the change.
At what age?
Quite the change.
Quite the change, you bet.
And, how old were you when you moved there?
when I was there, let's see, the first time it was, I must have been around 12, I was in sixth grade. And then we moved to New York, to Pleasantville. I stayed for a month in a hotel in Armonk first. And then I was there for junior high and ninth grade. And I wrote a I came into eighth grade and we had to write a paper on the most important machine, and I wrote about computers. My dad was applying for a job and how they were going to revolutionize the world. And they had just, I didn't know, but the eighth grade teacher just finished a section on all the primitive machines and how the wheel is the basis of life. So everyone wrote about the wheel but me, and I got a D on my paper.
And you were right.
Otherwise, I was a real good student. A really good student. And let's see. After New York, we went back to Wauwatosa, and we lived in two different houses there, different neighborhoods, still Wauwatosa. And that's where I met John. And then they moved to, and I graduated from school there. I don't know if I'm missing a few places. Does that count as
okay.
up as well? But while I was there and I thought that was where my parents would be, they moved to Baltimore.
Oh, wow.
Kind of broke me up with John. And then there's stuff I don't want to talk about. I didn't think I would talk about it, but take too long. Being a child.
That's fine.
And John and I got back together when he was at Dartmouth. Actually, I think he first learned about Dartmouth from me, because one time my parents were gone, and I was staying with this girl who was three years older than I was, and it was in the high school in Pleasantville. And really wonderful family, just wonderful. And her brother went to Dartmouth, so that's how I had heard it was such a good place. And
what year did you meet John?
Met John, let's see, I guess in 1963. Or no. When did I graduate? 1958. I was dating a friend of his and had a neighbor who was a friend named Marcia, and so I invited him over. You know, the four of us were there together, and John and Marcia were going, "John! Marcia." And I just thought, I wanted her to go out with him because I thought he was too good to waste. And we started going out, walked into town in the rain, all the way from the suburb into Milwaukee in rain. Went into an air conditioned theater. A lot of, you know, things like that. We didn't walk everywhere we went. We liked to walk.
Cool.
He's walking around this Copper Ridge place where he is now. Inside, it's all locked. Moving around usually.
Can you tell me anything about his childhood?
Oh, yeah. He was born in Milwaukee and raised in Wauwatosa. He lived in a total of three houses in his life, all of them within a bus ride of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So that's why he's very stable. His dad was Finnish, died very young from complications from diabetes. Young to me now is 60. And John was a really good student, and he was a football player and a, you know, track person, and just very patient, very reliable, just, and funny, funny. We both have this, pretty dark, but we both have the same sense of humor, and that's a story there, too. We got married at Dartmouth College in 64, and the minister asked us about our financial situation, which was terrible, and then he said, "What makes you think this marriage will last?" And we said, "Because we have the same sense of humor." And he said, "That's not enough." But he married us anyway. John actually was hoping that this rabbi that he liked a lot would be there and could marry us, but the guy who, I can't remember his name, but he was somebody John had a lot of respect for. And neither one of us is religious now. I mean, spiritual maybe for me, but no conventional religion. But anyway, and I think the minister who married us got divorced. Still married. And let's see, what else? The other thing, story that I always tell about us that would give you an idea is Christmas is a very hard time for both of us. Neither of us had happy families. John's parents drank a lot. My father drank a lot. And my mother was always sick or taking pills, and the only way you could get her attention was by being sick. I had asthma as a child, and I used to try to wheeze loud, you know, so she'd be nice. And anyway, so Christmas is not our favorite time, and we usually have some little fight around them, and then something happens, and usually something funny, and we make up. And so one year, I was doing the laundry, and we're talking, one of us, I don't even remember which it was at the time, said, "It probably is me, because I'm more melodramatic." "Well, this marriage is nothing but a farce." And so John stormed out of the room, slammed the door. I'm sitting on my pile of laundry, thinking, knowing that I'd been foolish, but still mad. And then John came back, opened the door, and we both at the exact same time said, "And let the farce be with you." We've been seeing Star Wars. And then we laughed and laughed, and then we went and played some prank on somebody, I think. But it's
a good one.
How far humor can get you.
Of course. It's a wonderful memory.
Yeah, and it kind of comes. I mean, these are all funny things if you look for them. And another thing I remember is we were in a hurry, and we were trying to get around Chicago and had to get gas and pulled up, and then something was pinching this hose, and this gas was going in the car like a drip at a time, you know. And we just both got, you know, we were so rushed, and we just both cracked up over that. Oh, well.
So you were married in 64. You met in 58. Were either of you political at this point? Were you sort of following what was going on in the world news and that kind of stuff?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yes, we both of us were always very political. I know, when I was in New York and we had to do some kind of little paper, I did something about Emmett Till. And both of us were really very civil rights conscious, and John's mother is a Holocaust denier, and John is is, you know how people, they would say, somebody would say, my best friend's Jewish. Well, at one point, like marriage, it was like, all our best friends are Jewish, including the maid of honor and the best man, and, you know, half off. So, you know, I mean, that's important. I mean, that's something good I got from my mother, is that, you know, she, one time, moving, in all this moving, a new friend I had made, we had agreed to wear our new spring coat this day, and I wore mine, and she didn't wear hers, and it just crushed me, and my mother said, she's not worth it. You know, if she doesn't do what she says she's going to do, then she don't feel bad, she's not worth your time. And that, you know, she told me, taught me to look for people who were genuine. And John and I've always felt like that. So we've worked for justice. And that's why we campaigned for Lyndon Johnson. And we were part of the Northern Student Movement. We tutored in Baltimore once, the summer of 63, I think. And we were in, I don't know, I can't get the time on the Civil Rights March. I'm pretty sure we were there, but we didn't even buy a button. And I think later somebody gave us a button from the thing and said, well, you know, you were activists, and I just went.
which march would that be?
Huh?
Which march would that be?
Freedom.
What year?
In D.C., the big one, the run.
The big one. One got you.
We were in both a civil rights march, and we were in the peace march when the buses rallied around the White House to protect President Nixon. And we had voted for Agnew, for jobs and freedom. Yeah, we went to the 50th anniversary of that, even though John had mentioned time. And Dartmouth was one of the best schools for the civil rights. I mean, while they were still excluding Jewish students from some art, or quotering Jewish students in other Ivy League schools, they didn't have that at Dartmouth. And then they had the ABC program, which was a better chance. So they had some, at that time, you'd say black students and faculty. And I remember Lloyd McNeil was a friend of ours. In fact, I'm looking at one of his works of art as I sit here looking out into the living room. And it's just, I don't know, when we lived in Vermont, we were campaigning for single-payer medical care, and, you know, and when John had dementia, we were part of the Everybody Can Win program where you read to students, and, you know, we've always believed in doing stuff. So.
Can you tell me a little bit about what it was like to march on Washington? Describe that experience a little bit.
John came back from Vietnam. That one?
Sure, yeah.
Because that was... Well, John... Okay, in... It was the end of 1966 is when he signed up to go...
Okay.
Army.
Yeah, we'll start there.
Can I jump there?
Yes, perfect. Start there.
Okay. What happened was, what he did was, after he graduated from Dartmouth and after we did some civil rights type stuff, then he went to Hopkins and got a master's degree. But after he got the master's degree, they offered him a chance to get a PhD and have even a little more money from teaching, And he turned it down because he felt like it was a seat, you know, not just too safe a life or something, I guess. I don't know. But anyway, but he got a job at an insurance company, and we were still in the area because I hadn't finished college. So I went back, and I had gone to back to college the year he was doing his master's, and then the year he was working. But the December of that year, he got a call from his Wisconsin draft board. And, of course, since he's not even in the state, you know, he's not going to have any way of wiggling out of that. And even though we thought the war was stupid by then, I asked about going to Canada, you know, and he didn't want to do that because then you can't come back, and I wouldn't finish college. So,
Where did you go to college?
The University of Maryland. And I had a scholarship, but I left that college. I'd first gone to Valparaiso because I thought that would impress John's mother, who was a staunch Lutheran. And it's not the best way of choosing a college, but we were both the national merit, like you're a finalist, but you don't get any money. I guess it's a semi-finalist or something. Anyway.
Right.
But John got, well, he had a full scholarship in Dartmouth, which he lost when he got married. And his father asked me, why did you get married? But he got through Dartmouth and did better after he was married. So anyway, I'm losing track of myself.
That's okay.
Yeah, okay, I'm trying to get to, yeah, it was, so he went to the draft board with a lot of guys from the football team at the University of Maryland, all of whom were too injured and were 4F. But he was like all A's, you know. So he didn't have a chance, and he was going to get drafted because he was out of state and he had passed physical with, you know, the exams with the really high marks. So he got, after he did that, he went around to the draft boards to see what the best deal he could get was. And he didn't want to kill anybody in the stupid war. So he went to the Medical Service Corps. He went to the Army and they got him in the Medical Service Corps. And he was commissioned as a reserve second lieutenant and got credit for, you know, having a college degree. And so then he went down to Fort Sam Houston, and in March he graduated from their program, and I think that's where he got his PBR training. But I know he got an award or someplace for, he has these, you know, we have this collection of sheets of paper, and outstanding, you know, use of the comma, you know, kind of thing. Anyway, he has something outstanding for his CBR training score. And so anyway, then they sent him, when he was sent to Ireland Army Hospital in Fort Knox, Kentucky. And I finished college, so from March till June, you know, as soon as I finished my exams, I left and joined John in Kentucky, and we lived off coast until probably around June, and then when we moved from this, we've been living in a basement in what's called E-Town, Elizabethtown, Kentucky, and let's see, oh, and when we moved in, we got chicken pox, I remember that.
Oh, no.
I have no sympathy for him because we had the downstairs. We had really good friends in this apartment building we were living in when I was going to school, University of Maryland. And the little children, this one family, all had chicken pox, and they never seemed very sick. And John was just, he was the most pitiful. I'd ever seen him almost. And I wasn't that sympathetic, but later I found out that's a big deal to have chicken pox when you're old. And then, so he was at Fort Knox, and he, I can read you some of the letter here.
Sure. So if you, just give me the date of the letter that you're reading.
March 15th, 1967. Okay. And I'll just read a part of it. Okay. As far as I can tell at this early date, I think this assignment will be at least palatable as soon as I learn my job. Well, actually job. In addition to being commander of the second hospital unit, I'm activities and recreation officer for the hospital, BBR officer, and will probably be security control officer. Captain Entolvi is young, on the way up, and pretty reasonable, a nice guy. It should be fairly pleasant working under him. At least he doesn't want to go to Vietnam. He also made the statement that he didn't ever want to receive the Purple Heart or the Medal of Honor. So it seems that he's pretty rational for a VMT graduate. Or VPM, whichever. Anyway, career-type soldier. He does have 4 children, of course, having seen the neighborhood in which Lieutenant Robert Dye lives. 4 seems to be low for a family. When you get here, everything will be fine, and we'll probably do better than survive. And that's true. That's the first time we had money. It was an army, and there was a commissary, and a, you know, oh, whatever the other store, I can't even think of the word you use for it, but military post, you know, that's a life for themselves, and it's John said sometimes somebody said something about Bernie Sanders being a socialist, and they were kind of militant person, and he said, well, you know, the army's just communism. Anyway, being home seems so remote that it's really hard to believe I was ever there only a few days ago. I already miss you as much as I ever did at Fort Sam. Well, in a few days, I'll feel confident enough to broach the subject of advanced leave with a good captain. Blah, blah, blah. And we got to know a lot of really nice people at that place. And Jim Entolvi and his wife were among them. And later on, and they were so pleasant and funny. And he, later on we found out that Jim was in the Tet Offensive. And oh, talking wow. to us, I asked, you know, he said, how did it affect him? And she said, he hasn't laughed. He doesn't laugh anymore. And that's just... That's, to me, the telling thing about that. That was just... People who want to start wars are just... So ignorant of what it does in so many ways. Because he was in the Medical Service Corps, and so was John. And I think a lot of the really bad things he's going through now with dementia are just left over from Vietnam. So he's sort of, when he's in the sort of Mr. Hyde state of mind, it's like he's asleep. It's just weird. And I mean, it does things to people that if you're a civilian you don't know, and I'm bitter about a few things because, okay, oh, and But he was proud of having the Bronze Star. He did. He got a Bronze Star, but, you know, not for saving lives, for rescuing somebody, but for being, you know, an outstanding soldier and being in a war zone. And I think he actually did save some lives, because he was once given a command to have his unit send some, carry some stuff over to another area, and that was on the perimeter, I guess. So anyway, he did that, and then he heard a shot, and he realized that where he'd sent these guys, there were new recruits. They hadn't been on post for as long as a lot of the soldiers had, and he realized that they, you know, usually they just had like incoming shells and nobody was firing at them from this perimeter. So anyway, John realized that what the situation was and called up and got them, you know, said, hold your fire. There's, that's, you know, this is equipment coming to you. This isn't, you know,
right.
If you, something moving in the dark right now, because it was right at the twilight time when vision is very dodgy. So that's what John figured out, was that he'd sent these men at a time of day when vision isn't clear over to where new recruits were, and so he stopped it right away, and nobody was hurt.
Wow.
But, you know, avoiding friendly fire isn't something you get a medal. Friendly fire by your commander is not something you get a patch for. But he did, you know, he did a lot of things. He did them honorably. The other thing, a couple of things associated with war that I was bitter about, I was bitter because when he left to go to Vietnam, I was 2 weeks away from the due date of our son, Eric, our first child. And so while he was in Vietnam, I had Eric. And anyway, he got to, but he didn't see him until he got R&R, like, 7 months later, maybe 8. And that was really good. Because we were talking about what to do for his R&R and didn't know what to do, and didn't, you know, I was going to go to Thailand, or he was going to fly to Maryland. You know, we thought of a lot of things. None of them really struck us as a good idea. And then these good friends of ours, Bob and Irina Graves, had a beach house in Hawaii, and they said, you know, come stay at our beach house and we'll stay somewhere else, and, you know, you can have the sports car and we'll run on the place. It's right on the ocean almost. So that's what we did, and I took Eric and as a little tiny baby to Hawaii. There are just a million stories I could go on and on too long. But I was really that he didn't, you know, that happened. And now people hear about it, at least, that these soldiers that go off, they leave pregnant women, they leave little children, and a lot of times, I did learn from a friend whose father was in World War II and never had a good relationship with his father, because his mother wrote nothing but letters about the baby to his sister. I did that. And the other thing is, actually, it bothered me. John went on to, you know, he pretty much did any job that came along. But his ability always got recognized, and he always got, you know, outstanding this and outstanding that. And when he left, he worked for the government when he came back. First he went back to the insurance company for a while, but then he got a job in the government. And then when he left government, he was the acting chief of that chief editor at SBA, but he didn't want to be the chief editor at SBA, so then we moved up to Vermont, to Norwich. And he was happy being up there, but the work life was terrible. I just felt like nobody gave him a chance up there. I know he wanted to write, and one time he applied for a job renting out rental cars at the airport, and the guy wouldn't hire him because he said he lacked management experience. Somebody with a bronze star, who's been a captain in a war zone, lacks management experience. For car rentals. He eventually got into the printing industry and worked his way up there, and we put up with the lousy jobs that are in the Upper Valley, unless you're well connected, and use that and work that, which neither one of us has ever wanted to do, you know, even if we could. And anyway, and so when our kids, we have two sons, when our sons graduated from Hanover High, we moved down to Massachusetts and rented a place. And then, and we were going to sell our house in Norwich, but it was February or January. Anyway, didn't rent. It was ugly part of the winter, like around later February. And we used to come back up on the weekends and shovel out the driveway and do this. And anyway, we ended up renting our house out, and that worked. But I was bitter about Norwich because they put up a memorial to the Vietnam veterans from Norwich. And even though we were living there when they put it up, they wouldn't put John's name on it because he wasn't living in Norwich when he went to Vietnam. And those other people, you know, were either born there or could afford to live there, you know, after college, because that is the place that captured, you know, we both love that area. We always love walking around the Bima, walking the trails and stuff. And it just made me mad that somebody that served, you know, in Europe or in the United States had their name on that memorial, and he didn't, because that war cost him. I mean, it paid for having a baby. That was something that was good. And we met a lot of wonderful people, but it changed him in ways that I think he's paying for now. He told me, he didn't tell me, you know, he's a real stoic. He's a Midwestern, wear white socks, you know, suck it up kind of person. Don't complain. And before he went to Vietnam, if we were in a traffic circle in the D.C. area and somebody wanted to get in, he would just slow down and let them in. And if he missed his exit, he would just go around the circle another time. And he still would slow down for people. But if he missed his exit, he went on off on the one right after that. He wasn't going to drive around. And then we would be lost, and we'd have to go find a hill so we could figure out how to get back to where we were trying to go. And other things, there are things he told me it didn't affect him. He was in the rear echelon. He wasn't in a really active war zone, you know, part of the war. He didn't have to crawl through the tunnels or anything. And yet, when he came home, if the fire alarm went off, he'd dive under the table. And one time, this was recently, because I said something about, you always said Vietnam didn't affect you, and you said, you know, but didn't you know I couldn't walk past the meat counter after that when I came back? And it's true. When we always grocery shop together, and when he came back, he wouldn't go, you know, past the meat counter. And he said it was because here he is with a baby he's never seen, and the medical service corps people used to go out on, I guess, all like MedPAC operations, but they'd go out into the countryside sometimes and help people. And so the people would line their injured children up along the roads, and sometimes they could stop, and sometimes they were on a mission to actually go someplace. So sometimes they had to drive past these injured children. And I do remember, too, one time, oh, John said something harsh, or something from Eric, and I had, you know, lived for Eric while John was in Vietnam, and I said, how can you be so mean, John? And he said, he's a spoiled American child. And when he came back to one time, at one time point, he was so distraught, I was going to leave him, but called my mother, and she said, oh no, it'll work out. You know, she wouldn't let me take the baby and come stay with him. And he was just so depressed, and he said, He was considering, you know, killing us all. And after he said that to me, he broke a spoon. And I'd never seen anybody do that. I mean, I've seen him, people crush beer cans and things, but and this wasn't real good, heavy, you know, stainless or anything, but he just broke it. So
it was pretty. Go ahead.
I have a friend whose husband was in Korea, another little prize war, but at least something sort of come out of that. You know, maybe North Korea is also, you know, that's also an outcome of the Korean War. Maybe all the sane people stayed in the South, or the ones that were harder to brainwash. But this friend of mine, her husband had shrapnel in his legs. And it just, you know, no sympathy. Oh, and there, when the Vietnam, you know, soldiers now still don't get treated in a way that makes, you know, it's still not great. And the Veterans Administration, I think they're trying, but they, you know, what the worst thing the Republicans ever did, in my estimation, and I think they were largely behind it, was to separate the costs of war and take them out. They were counting them as part of welfare, you know, like the charitable part, the part where you support schools and hospitals and you know, helping people, like they used to have domiciles back in the old days, like World War II, you know, the old soldiers, after they're alcoholic and wrecked, they could at least go someplace, and the VA paid for it, and it was part of what veterans need. But after a certain point, that started getting included in the non-military budget. You know, if you're going to have a military, all of that stuff should come out of it. And let, you know, Kellogg, whatever it is, CDR, what, KBR, those companies that make, they don't even have war profiteering investigations after war anymore. All this war that's non-war, nobody who makes money off of it has to pay the kind of cost that the soldiers pay. I'm for the old days, you know, give them big pointy sticks and let them run at each other on horses fast, you know, let the leader be, you know. Right until they're happy, settle it that way. And now with the drones, I really think Obama's a great president and one of the best that we've seen, although I think Carter gets little credit for even bringing any kind of peace to the Middle East. But Obama's using drones, and it just makes it more remote and easier to indiscriminately kill people. And I think Obama has a good sense to use it in a very cautious way, but that doesn't guarantee that the next president... You know, can you imagine Trump with a fleet of drones?
I don't want to.
Yeah, John can't vote anymore because he's mentally incompetent and he's locked up. But I'm going to go out and campaign this time. And I did last time, too. And, you know, that was something we would do. We would always, you know, I mean, we would talk politics, right up. So anyway, so I'm a screaming socialist, and I hope Bernie wins. And I'm upset because the women that are, I hear women saying, oh, you know, Hillary's a smart, good background woman, you know, if you're a woman, you should vote for her. And I just think, yeah, and there were a lot of people I knew who were intelligent black women who voted for, you know, who were saying that Clarence Thomas should get in because his prejudice was what was stopping him. And until they appoint Anita Hill to the Supreme Court, I'm going to be outraged, you know. You shouldn't be loyal to, you know, like my mother would say, you know, you should look for genuine people. It doesn't matter where they come from, you know, nothing else matters. There's a quality of genuineness that some people have.
So. Good thing to remember. I'd like to go back really quick to when John came home from the war.
When he came home from...
That? Yeah. You said that was 69?
Yeah, it was November of 69. And they wouldn't even hold the plane to let the veterans get on. That was, he was scheduled for some flight, but it took off before they delivered the guys from wherever they were holding the veterans on the West Coast. I went to the airport and had to come home and go back later.
Oh my gosh. So he came home, and you said he went back to working at his old job?
Back to work at the insurance company. It was a different job. He came back, they made him a systems analyst, I think.
Okay. And then you worked for the government? Oh, go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, then he got a job, let's see. Where did he work? At OOFSI, I think, which was the Occupational Safety and Health Review Commission. And that was just a new entity that they created to review the enforcement of the occupational safety and health laws. And that was a good bunch. And that was such an ideal job. But John, I don't think John ever had a job he was really happy. Oh, and the other thing was, I asked him about going to school when he came back, and he said, oh, he thought of being a lawyer at one time because his friend Chuck had done that when he got out of the military. And I said, are you going to be as remote as you were in graduate school? And he said, yes. I said, do you really, really want to be a lawyer? And he said, no. So you have things that I know. And so I said, I don't think that's a good idea. And then what he really wanted to do was to join the Army and go into the infantry because he thought he could save lives. And then I said, would you be assigned to Fort Huachuca? Would we move all the time? And he said, yes, you know. And that he said, I don't want to do that. I really don't want to do that to our kids. Moved enough as a child, but it's not as, when you're military, at least you're moving into a community where other people are moving all the time, but it's still not the best way to raise kids. And certainly not while war's going on. But that was the only thing he ever fixed a real desire to do. And the rest was just earning money to keep us going, you know. Or to be a writer. That's why this stuff is so important to me. Because what he always wanted to do and what he did so marvelously was write. And then to have that taken away from him. You know, we saved money. We could have lived so comfortably. But, you know, that's why I say, I mean, history doesn't, what happens, you're not in control of what happens. Things happen. Deal with it. And now we support Harvard Stem Cell Institute, and we are donating our bodies to science, and partly to save money for our kids, because there may not be any left after this at nursing home stuff. And partly because, John got the book. I think they reviewed it on Comedy on the Daily Show or something, Stiff. And John got it out of the library, and we read it aloud to each other back before he had been diagnosed with dementia. And we both thought that was really noble. You know, you can give your body with no big stipulations, and they might use it as a crash test dummy or whatever, but there's no substitute for a human body, so why not do something with it? And instead of having graves and the markers, we have our names on a plaque in the Silver Spring Library, because we use public libraries a lot in our lives. And that's not really about John coming back from the war, but that's...
That's okay. It's okay. The one thing I did want to talk about, though, was your experience marching in Washington.
Marching in Washington?
Yeah, you said after he came back.
Yeah. After he came back, yeah. Well, that was just... It was powerful for him to do that, for both of us. But he didn't want to give up his Bronze Star. I remember that. He wouldn't do that. But it was... I have a button from that one, though. And it felt so strong. And to see to see the buses around the White House, that was like, you know, you felt like, oh, it wasn't as party-like in a way. I mean, with the Civil Rights March, it was sort of real upbeat. Well, you know, you're singing "We Shall Overcome," and it seemed like fun. I mean, it was in the time of year when it's pretty down here, and I don't really remember what it was like when John came back from Vietnam. What time that was? If it was, you know, so early in the spring that it was maybe still cold. I don't think it was cold, but warm enough. But it was huge. It was huge. And they were reporting that the crowd was like 250,000, and they were saying that there were many, much bigger than that. It was just, you couldn't, and neither of us likes crowds. John and I are very, we're happy to be alone. We don't really need, don't like cocktail parties, you know, didn't like the fact that, Dartmouth or Hopkins particularly, not that kind of thing. Like, how to have friends that throw good dinner parties and enjoy them, but this is just, you know, you can't breathe. You can hardly turn around. It was just so crowded. And I don't remember a lot of it. I remember music. I mostly remember we got closer to the front of it in that march than in the civil rights one. But both of them were just huge. So, and it made me feel good. And it made John feel good, too. I mean, we were real glad we went. And I think it helped change things. And oh, and I also want to tell you something that you shouldn't admit to, but we, you know, because we were civil rights people, we went out and voted for Agnew. That's the only time we voted for a Republican, I think. But we voted for Spiro Agnew as governor of Maryland because the guy that ran... instead of having one of the liberal Tidings family run as a Democratic candidate, there was so much racist stuff going on in the country at that point that the Democrats had elected as their candidate some guy who could barely structure a sentence and whose motto was, "Hold your castle." I can't remember the guy's name, but it was racist jerk. But we actually campaigned somewhat for Agnew to keep him out. And then he becomes vice president. Good God. what I wish for this country is, I wish, if you're going to consider money and corporations as signs of free speech, you know, if money is speech, then you've got to keep your money in your state, in your voting district. You cannot spread it across the country. You cannot, you know, you can't bribe some yokel from, like Agnew, with money from interests that aren't right in Maryland. You know, I think that's a big mistake. I want to see money get out of the elections. That would be a big thing. That and the genetic research. It can all change for the much better, possibly. I hope you see it in your time.
Yeah, I hope so, too. All right. Well, is there anything else you'd like to talk about?
Excuse me, would you repeat that, please?
Is there anything else you would like to talk about?
What do you think about Vietnam after doing all this research? Out of being part of this project? Do you have any impressions?
I tend to feel the way that many of the people who I've spoken with feel, that it was an enormous human cost with not much hope of a good result. I don't know if you would put it a different way.
Yeah, in a purely pragmatic way, war is just pretty stupid. You blow stuff up. You know, you waste material and human lives. And the only good thing that came out of Vietnam is that there is, cat eating, long stuff here. is that you have communication with that part of the world. And the only good thing out of Nixon administration was the pandas. You know, I mean, but you could go and create relationships with other countries without trying to destroy them, you know. we got in it because the French didn't win, right?
Right.
Now there's a reason. Well, I just hope people. You know what I hope? Actually, I have several hopes. One is for robots that have compassion, empathetic robots. Let's see, what was the other? That in the genetic research and everything, people will finally have the ability to learn to live long, healthy lives so that they have to live with the consequences of their actions instead of their grandchildren living with them. That's what I'd like to see.
Gonna keep those in mind.
Okay.
Wow. So, all right. Is there anything else you'd like to say about Vietnam or the way that it affected your life, your relationship? And we've talked a lot about that. But if there's anything else you'd like to add,
I don't think I can. These are just like anecdotes. I think it affected us in some way that's, you know, sort of like John's dreams. You know, it's like just this thing that's not obvious, but it's definitely there. I know our sons have said, you know, oh, Vietnam, Vietnam, everything because of Vietnam. I heard that one. But it is. A lot of it is. A lot of things changed.
Do you have anecdotes you would like to tell?
Hmm?
Are there any anecdotes you would like to tell?
Let's see. Well, I'm sort of preachy, so I've done my preaching, but there are a lot of, you know, a lot of memories. It also leaves you with a lot of fond memories, like when we were stationed at Fort Knox, we had good friends and going to parties, and I've met this one woman, actually this couple were good friends of ours, and I learned a lot from this woman, because she was just a really great artist, and And she taught me that it's a lot easier to turn out really good products if you have really good equipment. I never realized that. whatever happens, you know, you can... There's always something you can get out of it, too. And there were good things about John's being in the military. And you know, now they have tours going to Vietnam and the shoes I like are made in Vietnam. So, but that time was just mostly just hanging on. Just glad when it was over.
Yes. All right.
Well, thank you for taking all this time and doing this. I really appreciate this.
Oh, thank you so much for speaking with me. It's an honor to hear your story and to hear John's story as well.
Well, I wish John could tell it because he knew it better. Oh, the one other thing. You know,
yes.
I said the march didn't really, you know, that was good, and it felt like, you know, you're having your say and it helps. It helps put things in a kind of perspective. But the thing that really hit John and me the most is seeing the wall. That is the best memorial to that war. And I know lots of people say that. I mean, that is the right way for that war to be captured, is with that memorial. To have some sculpture that was, you know, dramatic some way wouldn't say it like that wall does, with all the names. And wonder what it'll be like, you know, in 50 years, you know, if people will still come there, but I imagine they will. It always gets to John and me to see that place. So. And on the other hand...
Go ahead.
Okay, on the other hand, the World War II Memorial is like this, you know, tribute to unity and camaraderie, and, you know, it's not stark like the Vietnam Memorial is. So, they seem right. So, let's have no more, you know, the space is pretty much getting crowded on the mall. Let's just stop with this stuff, you know. Think it over, you know. How about you sign up if you're so Donald Trump? Go, you know, get your little gun and, or, you know, go talk to Putin or somebody, or, you know. So, anyway, good luck to you and your generation.
Thank you. I think we're going to need it. All right. And again, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you, too.